West Legal Aid Center would like to welcome you to the audio program, LIBOR, Securities, Antitrust, and Regulatory Implications. Please submit questions by clicking the Submit Questions button located directly under your viewer window. The program materials are located to the right of your viewer window. Thank you for joining us, and I will now turn things over to our moderator, Thomas Dubs, a partner with Labaton Sutro of New York.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to today's panel presentation regarding the legal allegations and the various problems surrounding the alleged manipulation of the benchmark London Interbank Offered Rate, or LIBOR. I'm pleased to be joined today by two colleagues. First, Bill Butterfield, who is a partner at Hausfeld LLP in Washington, D.C., where he chairs the firm's Financial Services Practice Group. He has broad experience in a number of different areas and has represented governmental agencies, companies, and investors in private litigation over securities, commodities, and antitrust. And as we will hear, he's actively involved, particularly in the antitrust cases that are now pending before Judge Buchwald in the Southern District. Secondly, we have with us Elkin Abramowitz, who's a partner at Morvillo, Abramowitz, Grand, Iason, Anello, and Bohr in New York City. Elkin is one of the deans of the White Collar Criminal Defense Bar, with long experience in handling civil and criminal matters in state and federal courts for both individual and corporate clients. Chambers recently ranked Elkin as one of the senior statesmen in the White Collar Defense and Investigations Bar. I prefer dean to senior statesman, but so be it. My own practice, and I am a partner at Labaton Sutro, focuses on the litigation of securities cases, including class actions, on behalf of a wide variety of institutional investors, including public pension funds, hedge funds, and banks. For example, we represented the fifth largest bank in the WorldCom case. Prior to, depending upon your point of view, joining the dark side or the light side, I was senior vice president and senior litigation counsel for the investment bank Kidder Peabody. We have arbitrarily broken up this discussion, which is somewhat overlapping in topics, into focusing on antitrust aspects, which Bill Butterfield will cover, then general issues regarding the outstanding investigations by the various regulatory and governmental agencies that we know about. And then I will cover some of the class action cases that are pending and are heating up, as well as some of the individual actions that are also relevant. We're going to try to do this by, I will give a introduction, then we'll go to Bill, then Elkin, then myself, and then we want to save at least 15 minutes for questions at the end. Though if you have a question that's particularly relevant to what the speaker is talking about, please feel free to submit it during that person's talk. As we all know, LIBOR is the average interest rate at which banks can borrow from each other in the short term. That is a somewhat deceptive statement in and of itself, because the more we learn about this, the more we find out that LIBOR is more of a series of estimates rather than a reflection of actual transactions. Moreover, LIBOR is not just one number. It is really several numbers that cover 15 maturities and 10 separate currencies. Historically, it was developed in the 1980s and was derived from what was viewed as a survey of banks that were conducted daily by the for the British Bankers Association in London, and they use Thomson Reuters as a collection agent. LIBOR is a primary benchmark rate used to determine the borrowing costs for literally trillions of dollars in loans. The best estimate is worldwide there are $800 trillion worth of transactions, adjustable rate mortgages, and other financial instruments that are governed by LIBOR. Banks use LIBOR to set the prices on derivatives, financial instruments tied to commodities, interest rates, and other assets. And with the advent and importance of credit default swaps, LIBOR is often a benchmark index in the swap market, which makes it particularly important. And as we know from the events a couple years ago, is intrinsically intertwined with the rest of our financial markets. In November of 2007, bankers and other market participants began expressing concern to the British Bankers Associations and others as to whether the LIBOR submitting banks were really reporting rates that were reflected their interbank borrowing costs, or they were manipulating it. In May 2008, the Wall Street Journal published an analysis with findings that a number of banks submitted significantly lower borrowing costs for LIBOR than what other market measures, such as credit default swaps and other indicia, suggested it should be. In March 2011, reports began to circulate that the Department of Justice, the SEC, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission had launched investigations into the alleged manipulation of LIBOR. And since that time, the British regulators and regulators from other countries have initiated similar investigations, focusing on whether false data was submitted by various banks to push LIBOR in one direction or another, and then whether this lowering of daily LIBOR rates was intentional, and whether the motive was to better their position on their swap positions or more globally to make their institutions' financial position look stronger. On June 27, 2012, Barclays PLC agreed to pay a $453 million fine, which is not precise because some of it was in pounds, to settle accusations by the United States CFTC, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the U.K. Financial Services Authority. Those agencies alleged that Barclays had colluded with other banks to artificially depress LIBOR, and as part of that settlement, Barclays admitted to manipulating LIBOR, beginning at least as early as 2005 through 2009. The extent of the LIBOR manipulation may have been more severe among banks other than Barclays. There's been a lot of commentary in the financial press on that. A recent analysis by the Nomura Group suggests that Citigroup may have been most severely manipulated in its LIBOR submissions, as well as J.P. Morgan Chase, but that is ultimately speculation. Citigroup CEO Mr. Pandit has stated to analysts that they should not consider Barclays' settlement to be a guidepost for what Citigroup may have to pay. And there's commentary in the British press that indicates that sources at RBS or close to RBS suggest that this fall they will enter into some sort of a negotiated resolution similar to the Barclays case. Starting in August 2011, many of the cases that were being brought were consolidated into a single multi-district litigation before Judge Naomi Rees Buchwald in the Southern District of New York, and we'll hear more about that from Bill in a moment. The possibility of other significant settlements continues to grow. The word in the press is that the Serious Frauds Office in Britain has opened a criminal investigation. The Florida and Massachusetts AGs have confirmed that their offices are investigating LIBOR issues, and the New York and Connecticut AGs have also confirmed they're conducting a joint investigation, quote, with the goal of providing restitution to state agencies, municipalities, et cetera. North Carolina, Department of State Treasurer, CalPERS, and others have also indicated they're looking at potential litigation claims, and there's been indications in the press that many large investment advisors such as Fidelity and Vanguard and BlackRock are gauging their clients' exposure and are, quote, weighing, unquote, litigation. So with that introduction, let me turn it over to Bill Butterfield, who is on the front lines in the Southern District, for a report of not only giving us an overview of what cases have been brought there, but what the status is. So, Bill, why don't you take over?
Thank you, Tom, and it's a pleasure to be on the panel with you and Elkin today. If I sound a little frazzled, we filed our responsive briefs to the motions to dismiss about a week ago, and I'm just now coming up for air. But I am very much on the front lines in the multi-district litigation. And I think what I'll do for starters is sort of try to give you all a scorecard, because it's pretty complicated, and there are, for a while it seemed like there were new lawsuits being filed every week, and it's a pretty complicated situation. So my firm, Hausfeld, is co-lead counsel with Sussman Godfrey for what's called the direct purchaser over-the-counter class. So our representative plaintiffs are the City of Baltimore, and there's a City of New Britain Fireman and Police Pension Fund. Those entities dealt directly with some of the defendant panel banks in doing LIBOR-related transactions. For example, Baltimore did interest rate swaps with some of the panel banks. There are two other classes and one opt-out litigation going sort of in active mode before Judge Buchwald, and there are some other cases that were more recently filed. So there's a class action asserted on behalf of purchasers of Eurodollar futures on the commodity on the CME. There's also a class that has been asserted on behalf of corporate bondholders who purchased LIBOR-related bonds but did not purchase them directly with the defendant banks. Finally, there's an individual opt-out action that was brought by Charles Schwab. And those four complaints are being actively litigated at the moment before Judge Buchwald. As I said, we filed our responsive briefs a week ago on the motions to dismiss. The defendants are required to file the reply briefs late this month. And at that time, the motions to dismiss will be fully briefed and before Judge Buchwald for her decision. I don't know when she'll make her decision. I don't know what she may notice oral argument. She hasn't done so yet. It's been our experience that Judge Buchwald has been fairly quick to rule on things. So, it's quite possible that she will rule on these motions before the end of the year. In addition to the four lawsuits that I just mentioned, there are a host of other lawsuits. Most of them were fairly recently filed. So there are lawsuits on behalf of two different classes of banks that claimed that they made loans to borrowers that were indexed to LIBOR, and they lost money when LIBOR was suppressed. And by the way, all of these lawsuits I'm talking about now are the focus of them are U.S. dollar LIBOR, but there are some newer lawsuits that one that was brought by futures contracts purchasers that purchased contracts indexed to yen LIBOR and Euribor. There are other newer lawsuits that were brought. There's one that's virtually identical to ours, but that was brought on behalf of entities that did not purchase directly from the defendant banks. There are some other new lawsuits that were filed in other courts, so they were not filed as related actions. There was a securities lawsuit, and there was another lawsuit involving Euribor. What Judge Buchwald has done with respect to these newer lawsuits is she stayed all of them, and she let the briefing on the motions to dismiss go forward on the four lawsuits that I mentioned first. And I assume that once she sorted out the legal issues asserted in the motions to dismiss for those lawsuits, that will impact the others, and we'll see where those stand. So that's sort of the scorecard of what's going on in Judge Buchwald's court. And as I said, we represent direct antitrust claimants. And we claim that the defendants colluded to fix LIBOR. There were different periods, and it's important to note there was a period that overlaps with our class period, but involves trader-to-trader conspiracies. And then there's a later period, which is represented in our class period, which runs roughly through 2007 to early 2010, in which we claim that the defendants colluded to suppress LIBOR. And the basis for our lawsuit, let me just hit the highlights. So we claim, and we've seen that Barclays has admitted illegal conduct with respect to U.S. dollar LIBOR. The UBS has entered into the DOJ Antitrust Conditional Leniency ACPERA program, which is reserved for parties who admit Sherman Act violations. During the class period, we spent a lot of time developing this for our consolidated amended complaints, but we hired several experts, and they took a look at LIBOR versus other benchmarks. And they found that during the class period, LIBOR diverged from at least five predictive metrics, including the Federal Reserve Euro-dollar deposit rate, a probability of default rate, CDS prices, Federal Reserve auction rates, and commercial paper rates. So the economic analysis leads one to believe that LIBOR was not acting as it should have compared to those metrics. In addition to that, we also found that the defendants' LIBOR quotes within our class period were clustered more closely than they should have been as compared to the varying rates of credit worthiness of the various defendants. And finally, there is evidence, and this came out from the Barclays settlements, that although individual LIBOR submissions were supposed to be secret until published, that the defendants exchanged proposed LIBOR submissions before submitting them, so they had advanced knowledge of what the LIBOR submissions would be, and that helped them stay within the pack, which was a phrase commonly used in the Barclays settlements and in documents that were revealed at that time. So that's the basis for our claims. That the defendants argue that, at most, they may have individually acted to submit LIBOR rates that did not reflect their borrowing costs, but there was no conspiracy to do that. So that's one of the big antitrust issues, whether or not there was a conspiracy. So the other antitrust issues is whether or not there was an antitrust injury. So the defendants say that LIBOR was an index and not a price. Therefore, there was no price-fixing conspiracy. The plaintiffs in their response in their briefs last week said that the rates of interest on a debt is very much the price that the borrower pays for using the lender's money, and that those rates were manipulated as a result of the defendant's conduct, thereby causing an injury, antitrust injury to the plaintiffs. In addition to that, there are standing issues, particularly with respect to some of the other plaintiffs' groups that did not purchase or do these transactions directly with the defendant panel banks. So under Illinois BRIC, which is a famous antitrust case, and the Associated General Contractors case, there's an issue as to whether or not these so-called indirect purchasers have standing, whether their claims are too remote. And finally, with respect to all of the plaintiffs currently litigating, the defendants have not surprisingly claimed that the complaints are insufficient under the Twombly-Iqbal standards, that the conspiracies that have been alleged by these plaintiffs are not plausible under Twombly, and obviously the plaintiffs strongly disagree and spent a lot of their briefs last week discussing those issues. So that's pretty much the lay of the land on the antitrust front, and I'll pass it, I think, to Elkin, who next?
Yeah, thanks, Bill, and thanks, Tom, for inviting me to be on this panel. I'm going to talk about what the facts are that are known to the public about whether there is likely to be a criminal criminal case brought here in this scandal. You may have been reading throughout the last several years complaints from the average citizen that there have been no prosecutions resulting from the financial crisis of 2008-2009. The reason for that is that not many companies during that period voluntarily disclosed to the Justice Department illegal conduct from which the Justice Department could launch a criminal investigation. For the Justice Department to do that on its own without the kind of help that it gets when it makes the kinds of deals that they made with Barclays here and are likely to make with UBS momentarily, the Justice Department does not have the resources to conduct the kind of investigation that would end up in criminal indictments. Here, the perfect storm has arrived because Barclays has entered into what is called a deferred prosecution agreement with the U.S. government, and since UBS has already made an agreement with the antitrust division under the amnesty provisions in the antitrust area, they are likely to end up trying to resolve their problems as an institution with the Justice Department as well. What a deferred prosecution means is that the bank agrees that it will help the government in its investigation into criminal conduct. And in exchange for that, they will not be indicted itself. I think many corporations, especially large corporations, especially banks, cannot really withstand the collateral consequences of not only a conviction of a crime, but even an indictment, because under many regulatory provisions and state laws, they will not be able to continue to operate as a bank while under indictment. So usually banks, when caught the way Barclays was here, they will try very hard to get a deferred prosecution agreement, and obviously Barclays successfully did that here. What that means is that if they've conducted an internal investigation, and the press has reported that Barclays had conducted its own investigation, spending $155 million, I believe, to do so, they will end up turning the results of that investigation over to the government. And what that will mean is that whatever conclusions as to individual responsibilities, whatever documents that they have gathered, whatever interview notes that they have from interviews that they've conducted with their employees will be turned over to the government, and the government will take it from there. What will happen is that individuals will get some notice from the government that they are interested, that the government is interested in talking to them. Generally, that means that an individual will hire a lawyer. That lawyer will try as long as he or she can to prevent the government from talking to any employee, unless some mutually agreeable agreement understanding can be worked out. In a case like this, where much of the evidence is probably contained in email traffic, contained in other documents, the odds that an individual can get himself or herself total immunity from prosecution is unlikely. What could happen is that, and the government will start with the lowest level of what they deem to be culpable people, to try to get them to cooperate with the investigation, which generally means a personal plea of guilt with exposure not only to fines but to jail. So that I fully expect that certainly with respect to Barclays, and certainly, and I think almost certainly with respect to UBS, and since they all dealt with other banks, eventually other banks, this will blossom into an enormous type of criminal scandal, which we haven't seen since the financial crisis. It may impact the civil cases, because if there are indictments, very often the U.S. Attorney's offices will, or the Justice Department lawyers, will go into court to seek stays of the civil cases, because, generally speaking, they don't want their witnesses deposed during the pendency of a criminal case. So that discovery, and judges who go along with this and grant the stay, they will grant a stay of discovery until the criminal cases are resolved. In this situation, the criminal cases here not only are not imminent, they're down the road certainly by a multiple of months. But when there are indictments, if and when there are indictments, those cases are not going to get resolved for at least a year or more. So that if there is going to be criminal action here, it will affect the civil cases. So now back to Tom.
Thank you, Elkin. Let me pick up a little bit where Bill left and try to cover the rest of the waterfront, or part of the waterfront, in terms of the other cases, many of which are pending before Judge Buchwald, that go off on either securities or commodities theories, or or common law fraud or other state theories that have been advanced. There are a number of cases, and I'll start from what may be the vaguest or the mushiest and try to get worked down to some of the ones that are more rifle shot cases. There's a case brought, usually it's referred to as the Baltimore case, brought by the city and officials of Baltimore that on the face of it deals with virtually all financial instruments. But most people, at least in the plaintiff's bar, think it is designed to cover OTC interest rate swaps. And assuming that that's a viable limiting definition of the class, one has to ask oneself, even as a plaintiff's lawyer, how that case is going to get certified. Because it's over-the-counter, there may or may not be a market that is deemed efficient. In addition to that, then one has to look, can you satisfy the standards of Rule 23 for reliance on an omissions theory under a case called Affiliated Ute? Or what we might also see is a resurgence of attempts to certify classes via the mechanism that hasn't been used since the limited partnership raft of cases in the 80s, where you have uniform documentation based upon the standard ISDA interest rate swap definitions. So that is very much of a sprawling case that will require a definition and will get tightened up either by the plaintiffs or by the court. On the other side of the coin, there's a case called the Metzler investment case, which is brought by a German financial institution, which is focused on exchange-based Euro-dollar futures, options, and other such instruments. The issue there, of course, is under the Morrison decision, the United States securities laws only apply to exchange-traded securities that are traded on a U.S. exchange. That is not the case, arguably, for over-the-counter securities. But how a non-exchange traded security passes muster and gets the application of the securities laws is an open question, and the Second Circuit is sitting on that in the swap context in the Porsche case. In addition to that, there is a separate bondholder case that purports to represent members of a class of U.S. dollar denominated debt securities. That's the Gelboim case pending before Judge Buchwald. We also have, in addition to the Schwab individual cases that Bill mentioned, we have a Berkshire Bank case that has not yet been consolidated, that has a class of all lending institutions, all banks and other lending institutions in the state of New York. It is before Judge Buchwald, or will be before Judge Buchwald, we assume, because it's predicated on diversity jurisdiction. And what's interesting about all these cases is the attempt to deal with the limitations of the Morrison decision by alleging fraud, unjust enrichment, and disgorgement. As some of you may know, common law fraud is alive and well in New York, and indeed there have been a raft of cases, some of which we're involved in, dealing with the RMBS situations, where there have been any number of favorable decisions by judges in New York's Supreme and the commercial part, suggesting that defrauded investors will get, if not a friendly reception, will not get a hyper-technical reading of what fraud means. But fraud still has the elements to it, and so one must have privity. So one of the threads that runs through all of this topic, be it from the antitrust side, which built touched on the Illinois brick decision, where one has to be a direct purchaser, one just can't be injured out there, to the fraud cases, is that if the allegations are true about LIBOR being depressed, there are lots of injured people out there and a lot of people who have been hurt, but what is the nature of the relationship between those people who were hurt and who they transacted business with? And at the very least, with the exception possibly of some of the securities cases where privity is not required or near privity is not required, there's going to be a sorting of those cases based upon whether there's a relationship with one of the bad actors. Let me now turn to what is, in effect, the cleanest, quote-unquote, case, and one that may end up being, in effect, a test case in this arena on the non-antitrust side, which is the securities fraud class action against Barclays that is limited to a class of ADRs. And because they are ADRs and they are traded on U.S. exchanges, there is a little doubt that the U.S. securities laws apply. So given the Barclays pleas and settlement agreements, given that this class is limited to ADRs, this is probably the straightest shot going with respect to this situation. But as some of you may know, ADRs are the float on the ADRs is a relatively small proportion of the overall float. So Barclays' float of ADRs is about 4% of its total equity flotation. One of the other interesting things is that the lead plaintiff deadline is coming up this Monday. The scuttlebutt in the plaintiff's bar is that there doesn't seem to have been a significant institution that stepped forward to lead the charge, and that may be of some concern if it's not handled properly. But that's reflective of an unintended consequence of Morrison, which is that a lot of U.S. institutions, when they buy Barclays, they buy it in London, but that transaction or those transactions do not have the coverage of the U.S. Securities laws. So we have a number of different fronts opening up and a variety of legal theories that are being tested or in the process of being tested, and we'll know more on Monday about how the Barclays case, which is the narrowest of these cases, looks. And with that, I have one question from a self-identified in-house counsel at a hedge fund saying, and I'm paraphrasing the question, how do I determine what my exposure is and how much was LIBOR manipulated? Let me deal with very briefly with the first one, and then I know Bill's experts have done a lot of work on this, and I'd like to get his input. How much was LIBOR depressed? Well, there's a 2008 Wall Street Journal analysis that is limited to the first 4 months of 2008, which suggests 25 basis points. There's a Fed study, New York Fed study, which is on their website, that has a longer measurement period of 07 to 09 that is based on interbank loans made through the Fed system. They conclude that it's around 20 basis points and could be higher at or about the time of the Lehman bankruptcy. Obviously, whether you measure a LIBOR against a credit default swap a baseline or some other baseline may make a big difference. We tell clients that you should look at least 25 basis points, and we think that's pretty conservative. So look at, assume for back of the envelope calculations, 50 basis points, and see where you come out. And then the next question that we've often gotten is, okay, I could do that, but I have a huge portfolio or series of portfolios. Is it worth the while, because I have some LIBOR-based investments that I may have made money on and others that I should have gotten more on? Do I have to net out the gains with the losses? And the answer to that is a lawyerly answer of it all depends, and there's no 100% clear answer, but there is, in our view, a spectrum of answers, which is that if you're only on one side of the transaction, then the netting issue doesn't come up. If you are, and one has to, even though one may from a in-house counsel's position look at the situation, or a business person's position look at it as one institution, one really does have to look at the individual legal entities and treat them as freestanding entities. So if you have losses in one entity that is a wholly owned subsidiary because there's a cousin subsidiary someplace that has gains, the case for netting becomes weaker. If you're talking about gains and losses in the same entity, well, then that's tougher. And it becomes yet even tougher depending upon who you did business with and who the counterparty is. If you have a counterparty and a series of transactions with one counterparty, then you're probably going to the net, or the chances of netting being advanced as a viable affirmative defense increased dramatically. Bill, why don't you give your thoughts on what your experts have found as to the amount of the depression of LIBOR?
Well, let me say a number of things. First, as I mentioned earlier today, there were two things going on. There were trader-to-trader conspiracies, and the relative effect of those conspiracies was far less than the overall suppression period. So, and based on public reports, and I want to distinguish. I'm talking now from public reports because I don't want to blow any work product privileges. But based on public reports, that I've seen reports of 1 or 2 basis points for those per transaction for those trader to trader conspiracies. For the general suppression period, I've seen public reports that say as much as 30 to 40 basis points, so a much greater effect. Is it worthwhile measuring your losses? Let's just say, I should have pointed this out earlier, I spoke about the U.S. litigation, and that's a typical U.S.-centric view of the world. There's going to be litigation all over the world. Particularly in the UK. So we have a London office, for example, and our London lawyers are talking with clients all over the world. And we've hired experts. They've developed models for different LIBOR currencies. They're still working on models for some of the currencies. But we've had clients talk to us and run their transactions through these models so that they can get an understanding of A, whether they have losses, B, whether they're netted. And I agree with Tom, it's a complex issue. I think for antitrust, there's less of an argument that netting for at least different LIBOR transactions is appropriate. But we're running now portfolios through these various damage models so the clients can get an understanding as to the extent of their losses. And there are clients in the United States that are trying to determine whether or not they remain in the class or whether they opt out and litigate on their own. So there are a lot of decisions being made right now. I would say that in the UK, as usual, the decision making takes longer. The litigation process is not as quick as it is, at least to launch litigation, as it is in the United States. But those sorts of analyses are being conducted right now.
Yeah, let me just add to that that there, as everyone knows, there the contingent fee system in the UK does not exist, at least for commercial cases. So one has to purchase various kinds of insurance. So there's the preparatory logistics are a bit more complex, but hopefully one can get to the same result. We're looking at those cases too, and I also have a question about. Since we're talking about things international, what about forum non? But before I get to that, let me toss one to Elkin, which is that one of the interesting aspects of this that may just be political tidbits but may have some legal implications are that there's a series of emails that have been circulating wherein this is Tom Dubb's interpretation of these emails. Secretary Geithner, when he was head of the New York Fed, indicated that he knew of the problem or at least knew of the complaints and indeed sent an email to Sir Mervyn King, head of the Bank of England, and this is my word, nudging them to perhaps take a closer look at this and be more rigorous about this. Does that level, Elkin, of government involvement or knowledge by the U.S. without the U.S. Immediately jumping all over Chase and Morgan and Bank of America, how does that play into the prosecutorial discretion decision, if at all?
Well, I think it's more of a political embarrassment than anything else. I don't think it has any particular legal significance. If you recall, in the Bernie Madoff scandal, many people tried to tip off the SEC that there was something wrong with Madoff, and the SEC didn't do anything. It ended up to be an embarrassment to the SEC, but not a bar to any criminal prosecution that was brought against Madoff and people who worked with him. So I think it's an embarrassment. I think if the call had gone to the Justice Department, it would be even more embarrassing were they to want to then go around and now and prosecute. But going to the Fed, as I say, I think is simply more a Geithner-related issue than anything else. It's not going to affect the prosecutions, it would seem to me.
And now on the forum non question, I mean, it's a good question given that depending upon how the facts develop, if the hypothetical is that the traders in London were submitting phony information to the British Bankers Association through their agent, and maybe some British-based senior officials in the banks knew about it, but Mr. Pandit or Mr. Diamond or somebody else or even someone of lesser rank arguably didn't know about it. is that conduct strictly UK conduct such that it would support a forum non-motion, even if you can convince a judge that New York fraud law applies or that the securities laws apply? What do people think about that?
Well, Tom, we really haven't been faced with that issue yet. I wouldn't be surprised to have it come up. I don't know whether the litigation mechanism is such in the UK to, for example, there's no effective class mechanism, so there are lots of issues that you would have to address. To that, I can see, though, one taking a position that there ought to be jurisdiction in the UK courts for any of this. But it's an interesting issue.
But and from a criminal point of view, it's not quite a form of nonconvenience, but there are going to be fights with the Justice Department and the British authorities over access to documents. I believe that the British authorities may claim that the U.S. can't simply subpoena documents from Britain that may be relevant to the investigation. Sometimes they work these things out cooperatively, sometimes they don't. So that could end up being an obstacle to a faster resolution of any criminal matter.
And with respect to documents, it's a good point. There will be cross-border data transfer issues in this case, because you have different privacy laws all over the world, and documents are going to be coming from all over the world, and that's going to be a pretty challenging issue wherever this is litigated.
Is it fair to say that as part of the quid pro quo of settling with Barclays or settling with UBS, assuming it occurs, or settling with RBS, assuming it occurs, that the regulators will make it a part of the quid pro quo that a lot of information has to be made public, either by virtue of a in sort of the SEC model, a draft complaint, which then is the subject matter of a consent decree or something like that. So I guess the question is, to what extent are the governmental agencies by these settlements going to spring the documents?
Not if there's going to be a criminal case or a series of criminal cases. They will not release those documents, at least until the criminal cases are resolved. They will keep those documents under wraps. I do see, by the way, a question about what are the regulatory agencies doing to make sure this doesn't happen again. I believe that, at least with the CFTC and certainly with criminal prosecutions, the effort in making these cases and making public all of these allegations is to deter other people from doing it. So to the extent that that works, and, you know, there are theories as to why deterrence isn't really working all the time, the theory would be deterrence. They see that not only would Barclays have pay an enormous fine, there are people's lives involved who had to be fired or worse, indicted. So that is supposed to be the theory behind making sure this doesn't happen again.
And the regulators, in England have already undertaken a study, and I think it's almost certain that there will be more in the United States and England and in other countries. There will be additional regulatory studies as to what happened and proposals as to reform.
Well, there's been a Wheatley study, or at least in draft in the UK, that suggests that the way to go is to have a a blended base of actual transactions versus estimates from the banks on a daily basis that would ground the numbers or the submissions in some sort of transaction-based reality, and that would make the whole process less susceptible to manipulation. I mean, we have a problem that there are so many ISDA swap agreements and other agreements out there that are governed by LIBOR to say we're not going to use LIBOR. I think there's going to be tremendous pushback for finding something else, at least in the near term, so that the best hope is deterrence model, which Elkin addressed, and then the restructuring model, which the regulators may or may not implement.
I missed the lead-in question. So you... The models?
Well, the you can change. I mean, the British Bankers Association can say we're still computing LIBOR, but the rules of the game, if they weren't clear, are now going to become clear that any number you submit has to be composed 50% of transactions that your financial institution actually engaged in, and we can audit that, and will audit that, so to get the numbers based upon real transactions, as opposed to what has been hypothesized as at least part of the motive in the Barclays situation, which was to make it look like other banks would loan Barclays, at least on an overnight basis, funds on a favorable rate, and thus the rest of the financial community, the quote city unquote, viewed Barclays as a quote strong unquote bank. That has been asserted as one of the motives, and of course other motives that have been asserted have been individual traders attempting to manipulate it so that the swap positions of their institutions would pay off or would improve financially.
Of course, I assume one of the responses to that, however, will be that during the financial crisis, there wasn't any lending going on at all. So how do you set a rate based on actual lending when there's no lending going on? So it'll be interesting. I'm not as involved on the policy end, but it'll be interesting to see what the regulators and legislators do.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think the one thing that all of this has made clear is that a relatively few people on Earth can, by virtue of manipulating what turn out to have been estimates or guesses, have affected trillions of dollars in transactions, and that one doesn't have to be a over-regulatory zealot to suggest that perhaps that situation should be looked at. I am seeing that we have no other questions, so Bill, do you have any final thoughts? And then I'll turn it over to Elkin.
Well, I hope this case will be resolved sometime before I retire, but I'm not sure if that's the case. It's going to be a long haul.
Elkin?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, but I do think, as I said earlier, that the criminal cases are going to be exploding here because of the fact that the banks are going to as institutions are going to make deals with the Justice Department, and there's going to be a series of criminal cases that are going to follow.
I have a sort of a less than a bleak house scenario in mind. I think that these classes are pretty broad sweeping, and whether it's Judge Buchwald or someone else, they're going to be tightened up. The issues of privity or near privity are going to screen out a lot of people who've been injured by LIBOR being in their ARM mortgages, but that's going to be some collateral damage. And so it's not going to be over tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but I'm not sure it's going to go on for years, at least in the U.S., where we have really three major financial institutions as the targets. It's not like the S&L crisis or a number of other or the credit crisis in general, where from the point of view of the plaintiff's bar, there's a more target-friendly environment.
Tom, is that there are going to be more banks involved?
I think there are going to be more banks involved. I think there's clearly going to be more banks involved on the criminal side. I think that I think the open question is in light of, if not the wording of Morrison, but the general view of keeping class actions contained, which is reflected in the Walmart case and other cases, the district courts are going to try to narrow this so that they can control it and not make it a sort of an unmanageable blob. Now, Elkin's quite right. It's an open question as to what extent the foreign banks, even in a tightened scenario, are still in the mix. So with that, I one last shot. I have not seen any further questions, and so I thank everyone for listening. And it's a very interesting topic, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. So have a good afternoon. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for selecting West Legal Aid Center. For optimal savings, why not consider a customized subscription? You'll get unlimited access to the largest, most current CLE library offered online. Call 1-866-765-MCLE for more information on how to maximize this opportunity. That's 1-866-765-MCLE for continuing education that's always comprehensive, always relevant, always current.